This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Normal Town Council member Kathleen Loren says she wants another term and will be a good steward for the public. That includes pulling back, perhaps, on a library project.
Given some new information and new realities, maybe we do need to explore some other options.
Loren says in a GLT interview she does favor economic development projects. Plus, Ryan Denham looks at the student apartment business as ISU and IWU prepare to go back into session. Move-in happens next week. And John Norton gives us the punk sound of the music of City Mouse. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Normal Town Council member Kathleen Lorenz is running again. Lorenz started her announcement with the idea of stewardship and ended it with the same words.
Because I think overall that's a very important aspect, if not the most important aspect, of being a town trustee. I mean, holding my hands like in a cup, like taking care of something. We are good stewards of this. We need to be good stewards of the resources of our community. And town council members come and town council members go, and we need to keep the town in good standing from one generation to the next, from one body of leadership to the next. And so I really take that role quite seriously.
Well, unpack the word further then, because a lot of people, when they say they want to be careful stewards, that tends to be code for spend as little as possible and on the basics and basic services and not try to do too much. Mm-hmm. How do you view that word? Is it more expansive than that or not?
I have a more expansive view, Charlie, than that. I also recognize that we need to, I mean, there is the old adage of sometimes you have to spend a buck to make a buck, you know, you hear that sometimes in business. And we need to be thoughtful and very judicious about the investments that we do make. And economic development is arguably one of the biggest issues for us to, and us, I mean, our region, Bloomington, Normal, McLean County, our region to be tackling. I, you know, referenced some of the changes going on that have gone on just in the last 4 years and are continuing to be on the horizon for our employers. And we need to be very deliberate with our plans to shore up, deepen, broaden our economic base and diversify, perhaps would be another word in there.
How should those efforts be best targeted?
The efforts for economic development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we need to be targeted and be deliberate with our efforts. And I think be an advantage is a good roadmap to follow, a good plan to follow. We need to be committed to that as a community, larger community in terms of Bloomington, Normal, McLean County.
90% of economic activity, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, is by small businesses,
mm-hmm.
not the shoot for the moon type of
right.
big businesses.
Right.
So are we properly directing economic development efforts externally, or should we be more focused on internal entrepreneurial and business incubator type things?
Right. You know, I'm not going to claim to be an expert in economic development. That's why we, as a council, should make sure that we have the experts in the community to do that. I do believe that our economic development leadership, obviously, is going through a transition right now with the EDC. And so as an investor of the Economic Development Council, as a council member, I would want to make sure that we get the right people in place and have the proper leadership and expertise to be able to answer those questions.
Other than economic development, what is your vision for the town in the next 4 to 10 years? What needs to happen to maintain that stewardship of the town as an expansive and livable place?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the town has always been very good at our planning efforts. And so continue the pattern that we have been doing for decades on planning and our annual strategic planning retreats that the council does, I think, is an extremely helpful exercise in taking stock of what's going on and setting a course of direction for the staff. So continue to do that. I'm gonna be honest with this and maybe sound a little bit more negative than I like to be, but you know, we do have to be mindful of the changes and uncertainties. And I use those words deliberately because while we are in uncertain times, maybe a little bit of uncharted territories in terms of particularly the significant changes we're seeing with our major employers, is that we'll just need to be more thoughtful and careful about the expansions and investments that we do make. We're not short on plans. We have lots of visions and, you know, that we've outlined here to this point with respect to Uptown and Uptown 2.0 as kind of our core district of business and economic. You know, we have to always keep in mind other aspects of the town as well, North Main, our stretch of Veterans Parkway. And so, you know, we have to keep those wheels moving, but I would foresee that we would need to do so in a more thoughtful, maybe judicious way. Not to stop it and keep it, you know, to a screeching halt, not to paint this picture of the sky is falling. And that's, you know, that is not me. But I am also realistic and practical minded enough to realize that these are uncertain times. And kind of back to my analogy of the household, you know, it might just be for the next 6 months, 12 months, whatever that time frame might be, that we just need to hold tight on a few things. And I think you've seen that happen already, to be honest. You know, we've seen that with respect to, you know, the library, for example, is probably a good one that, you know, you start to see some conversations happening among their leaders as far as, well, what are some other options we could do? Not to say that the new library idea is completely gone, but by any means. But, you know, given some new information and new realities, maybe we do need to explore some other options. And so those would be the kinds of, you asked back to the question of, you know, what do I foresee? While these uncertain times continue to exist in the manner that they are for us, we would need to exercise that kind of caution.
Thoughtful and judicious. Hold tight on a few things. That adds up to slower initiatives, slower to roll out. So what takes precedence in a priority sense? What do you green light? What right. would you green light right. as opposed to what would you hold tight on?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, we've had a number of economic development type of votes that I've had to consider. You know, there's no clear-cut litmus test for it, but I just know that what I have looked for and what I have supported are opportunities where the investment looks good insofar as the prospect for jobs and meaningful, you know, I want to say it, you know, substantial jobs that can be a living for a homeowner, a household.
Decent wage jobs, living wage jobs.
Exactly. There's the term I was looking for. Not to diminish the need and the existence of other more entry-level jobs, but, you know, I look for those more substantial types of jobs that help to spur economic activity, because now if we've got decent living wage jobs, those wage earners in turn, you know, it's economics. They go and buy things at the store and TVs and, you know, other household items. And so those are the kinds of investments that we should still keep actively looking for, and, you know, not necessarily by pass up opportunities for that. You know, things that may attract visitors to the community. You know, in the last 4 years, we've done more to develop our presence as a Route 66 stop along the tour. So, you know, that gets a little more into the recreational and tourism side. But nonetheless, those are placemaking and, you know, destination-making investments that can also benefit the economy, because that brings them to town, to our restaurants, fill up with gas, maybe stay a night in a hotel, so forth.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Kathleen Lorenz, a Normal Town Council member who has just announced her candidacy for re-election. Continuing the thread of priority setting, you've already talked about the library and been complimentary of the library in rethinking the Cadillac version to something perhaps more affordable for the town, at least on the near term. How about the prospect or potential for a multi-sport complex? Is that one of those hold-tight areas where it's just $44 million is too big a bite right now, or what?
Yeah, I chuckle because this multi-sport complex has been a very complex issue and one that we've...
A complex complex. It's enough to give you a complex.
and for the last decade, I think, you know, we've been kicking this around. No pun intended there. And I said this, I think, in some other public statements, I really will strive to separate some emotion that I think surrounds that and has continued to surround that opportunity from a business opportunity. And the business opportunity we should not lose sight of is the fact that it is an economic, potential economic development project, in that it's tapping into the youth sports tourism industry, an industry that traditionally has been very immune to any ups and down cycles and somewhat recession-proof. It is a viable industry that we ought to look at being a part of. And it is also one that shows some revenue streams in. I was quite impressed with the study insofar as it got down to the feasibility study, that is, by SFA. It got down to a level of detail that projected what potential, based on what they projected to be visitors to town for this particular industry, attracting people for youth sport tournaments, what that would mean in terms of potential tax revenue to the cities, so the local, the county, and the state. And, you know, that's a revenue generator. And you got to take a serious look at that. So that's the business side of it. The other side is emotion. And we can't dismiss that as real insofar as we've, as a community, we've been down this path of building a entertainment venue. It's, you know, been fraught with some controversy and perhaps some disappointment.
You're talking about the arena in Bloomington.
Correct. And I think that does influence some people's opinions about this. The other thing that causes, I think, some emotion about this particular topic is that it involves youth sports. And, you know, if you've ever been to a Little League game or, you know, anything involving Junior and, you know, his teammates or her teammates, it's an emotional experience for most parents, you know? And so I think when people think about, well, when my kid played soccer or when my kid played baseball, you know, we all walked uphill back and forth in the snow, you know? It's the memories that we have, you know, are rooted in some real emotional framework. And so I'm really going to try to advocate that we try to separate those two issues, kind of the fact from emotion, honor the emotion because it's real, but at the same time, don't let it overshadow the facts of the matter.
What are the preconditions that you would have for a potential yes vote that have not yet been laid out there?
Well, I think that a significant criteria for me will be private and public involvement. And I say that for the same reason that I was kind of talking about it being a business endeavor, as well as there's kind of a mission side of this. You know, the mission side being a great place for, you know, junior to play sports and, you know, more on a recreational level. And some might look at that as more of a want than a need. So you've got this mission side and you've got a business side. And so because of that, because especially of that business side, the influence of a private investor, private entity, developer, however they want to identify themselves, I think will be key to make sure that it does run in a way that is as efficient and goal-oriented as possible.
So how do you slice that bang for the buck question? Is it half public, half private? Is it three quarters public, one quarter private? How many jobs have to be created? At what wages? What are your metrics there?
Yeah, you know, that's really kind of, it'd be premature for me to go down that path. You know, we have to first find out if there's any interest on a private sector.
How much space do you think the capacity does the town of Normal have? If they don't have capacity for a $20 million library, then how could you say there is capacity for a $22 million share of a $44 million sports complex? And that is assuming that Bloomington comes on board this, which is also a matter for public discussion.
Right, right. Well, I'm going to say a difference here between those two projects, and I don't mean it to come across as negative to a library, because as anyone knows, I love a library, and I'm an ardent fan of reading programs, and especially ours, I think, does a fantastic job. However, a big difference between those two projects is that a multi-sport complex does have a revenue stream insofar as the tourism that would bring to this community. And we saw that in the feasibility study. Now, you could also say that a little more indirectly, the library is a good location and asset to a community without a doubt. It would spur, like we've seen with, say, like the Children's Discovery Museum, it spurs other development around there. So, you know, it too has a benefit, but in a more indirect fashion. The sports complex as a product, if you will, as an economic development project, has revenue streams.
So you'd place that above a library, you know, on the priority list.
Oh, you know, you're sounding like our the exercises that we do at our strategic plan. You know, I don't know that I'd go on record at this point to say, you know, make a binary choice about that, but it would definitely factor into my decision making.
What other projects are somewhere on the list? Not asking for a specific slot.
Right, right. You know, I think that we have to continue to look at, in terms of development, you know, the continuation of making our Uptown district a vibrant place. We are seeing encouraging signs that the vacant lots still in the Uptown 1.0, phase one, are drawing interest from developers. So we stay the course on that. You know, I'm always one to want to make sure that we don't neglect other aspects and other parts of our town, North Normal, North Main, being, you know, one of our entry points, North Veterans Parkway. So we always will have to look at all of our business districts. At the same time, you know, we also need to be mindful of our property owners. you know, and making sure that we keep a close eye on how property values are going, you know, leading us back to some of the shifts that we're seeing in our major employer here in town and what that might, how that might play out. You know, there's, you know, different theories and thoughts and concerns about property values and so forth. So we need to, that's more of the cautionary side of me that I would take into the second term.
Normal Town Council member Kathleen Lorenz says she is proudest of her analytical approach to governance in her first term. She says she has not been afraid to be a dissenting vote on occasion and would continue to think constructively and critically in a second term.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, offering vehicle loan calculators, consultation, and rates for new and used cars, trucks, or SUVs. Additional information available through the Vehicle Loan Resource Center at statefarm.com. State Farm Bank, member FDIC. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up on GLT's Sound Ideas, the American dream used to include a comfortable retirement. Now less and less is that the case. IPR reports on working through the golden years. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Before the story on older Americans, though, here's one about the up-and-coming generation. Next week, students return to Illinois State University's campus. As another school year looms, there have been some mixed signals about the health of the student apartment building business in Normal. Landlords recently resolved a long-running dispute over their property taxes, saying they were too high, and some, but not all, objected to the new recycling ordinance, saying it will raise rents. At the same time, three new apartment buildings near ISU's campus are weeks away from opening, a sign at least someone is making a buck. To sort it out, GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with landlords, developers, students, and Normal Town officials about what led to the student apartment boom and why it may be over soon.
Morgan Anderson is a junior nursing major at Illinois State University. One of her dreams for senior year is to live at the Lodge, the massive apartment complex on Willow Street that, from the outside, looks like where multimillionaires would spend the night after going skiing.
Like, that would be so cool. But then again, like, reality kind of hits, but that's way too much money.
That's too pricey for Anderson, who works and has loans to pay her own way through school. Instead, she's in a more modest townhome with three other students, paying $615 a month. Even that's a stretch. When you ask Anderson about the Lodge, with its granite countertops, guest bathrooms, pools, hot tub, she doesn't sound resentful about not living there or the high rent.
I mean, it is expensive, but it's worth it to me, and I'm sure a lot of other people feel that way, too. Just have your own place and be on your own. I don't know. A nice feeling.
The off-campus student housing business has changed drastically in the last decade, when ISU closed and then demolished two giant dorms and pushed 1,500 students into the private sector. Landlords, many of them developers themselves, have responded by building fancier and fancier apartments, trying to meet the demands of a modern college student.
That's continued this summer as builders put the finishing touches on three new apartment buildings surrounding ISU. The Summit on Dry Grove Street replaced two older buildings that had only four units each. Stadium Suites will have 24 units, 84 beds, where a demolished gas station once stood across from ISU's Hancock Stadium. And the biggest project is the $18 million expansion of the Lodge, adding 263 beds to the 300 that were already there.
It's been like that year after year. Townwide, Normal has seen 59 new apartment buildings with over 1,000 units built over the last decade, many for ISU. 20 years ago, 40% of undergraduate ISU students lived on campus. Now it's about 31%. There are signs that the new construction boom may soon be over, including the possibility of more on-campus university housing at ISU. Andy Netzer is general manager and managing broker at Young America Realty, the largest student landlord in Normal.
With this project and a couple others, we're probably at saturation point, where it's the supply and demand is probably shifted a little, and I think for the next couple of years you'll see not a lot of new construction coming on. And if we did more of this, we'd be creating our own vacancy.
I toured the lodge construction site with Netzer a couple of weeks ago. He showed it off like a proud father. The units have one bathroom for each tenant, plus one for the guests. There are stainless steel appliances, granite counters, and stained cabinets in the kitchen. The nicest unit has a spacious balcony overlooking the pool and hot tub. Inside, an antler chandelier hangs from vaulted ceilings with exposed wood and track lighting.
We're expecting that some five-year-old in the suburbs of Chicago may be occupying this in 15 years. And what kind of expectations is that person going to have? For what kind of home did they grow up in? Did they have granite counters in their kitchen? Did they have their own bathroom? And I think as we see a trend line increasing of what students are used to and what they're expecting, we want to meet that market, not just for today, but for the future.
All that comes at a cost. Rent is between $700 and $1,000 a person. Netzer says it's the top of the market.
A lot of pricing, the Young America portfolio does look at, well, what's the pricing of the lodge, and everything then can kind of tier down from there.
Oh, okay, so the lodge is sort of a market setter in that respect.
Right. Nothing else on campus can probably expect to command higher rents than here. So, and nor can they increase rent over time. Could they increase rents if the lodge is not increasing rents? And if ever the lodge is decreasing rents, so they should take a hard look at decreasing their own rents.
Netzer says they're not having any problem finding students who want to pay that higher rent for more amenities. Quite the opposite. The new lodge, which is co-owned by Young America owner Ralph Endress, has been fully leased since October 2017.
We also see that the appetite for our most economy properties is falling. So when we hear people say there's just, you know, this lodge is incredible, but who can afford all that, and they're going to run out of affordable housing for people, we really don't see that problem. What we see is we've got too much of the affordable and not enough demand for it. So the softest part of our portfolio is the apartments with the least amenities, with four bedrooms and only one bathroom, with no dishwasher. And some of those can be modified, but we cannot very easily add bathrooms. And where we can, we have been. We're remodeling a building this summer also, and we have been, had a history of, you know, one or two buildings every summer, trying to add bathrooms where we can and overhaul them and bring them up in terms of amenities.
Morgan Anderson, the nursing major, is also the Secretary of College Affordability for ISU's Student Government Association. She says it's hard to find a nice place to live for less than $550 a month.
I think it's really overpriced. Just from my one townhome, they make like $2,400 from us every month, and like that's crazy because it's only a four bedroom apartment. It's not like anything big or special. And I know people that pay rent like not in a college town. It's so much cheaper. You can get so much more for your money.
Property owners say they're responding to demand. Ed Souter had owned the two apartment buildings on Dry Grove Street since the late 1970s. That's where the Summit is going up.
And they were probably built in the early 50s, maybe late 40s. And we were having a little harder time renting them. Their amenities were limited. The rooms were small. Bathrooms were antiquated. And we would have had to done a major rehab, thousands and thousands of dollars. And we thought, do we want to put that kind of money into an old building that's kind of outdated and didn't look quite right? So then we elected to bite the bullet, tear them down, level the lot, and then start from scratch and build a new building.
That's how the Summit was born. The $4 million-plus building opens next month. It'll command higher rents, between $725 and $1,100, in part due to its proximity to campus. Its mountain theme, with stairwells named after Mount Everest and Denali, was inspired by Sauter's own passion for the outdoors. So how did Sauter know how to price the rents?
Extensive market research on what the vacancy rate is with various levels of apartments that have offer various services or various sizes and convenience. We see what's renting, what's not. I guess I just have to say it's something that's comes from experience.
The town of Normal sets certain parameters for new apartment construction, such as parking, setbacks, how tall it can be. But nothing in the town code is dictating that places like the lodge have to have a clubhouse with stone fireplaces, a leather couch, and a pool table.
And those are decisions, again, that are completely on the private side.
That's town planner Mercy Davison.
The expense level is tied to the amenities that are being provided on these properties that are far beyond what the code would require.
In addition to new construction, Normal has also seen many landlords embark on costly summer remodeling projects to make their older buildings more attractive to students. It's according to Greg Tremmel, inspections director for Normal. He says they're reworking kitchens and changing four-bedroom, one-bathroom units into three-bedroom, two-bathroom units with laundry.
They continually are modifying these units to try and avoid having a four-bedroom sit with just two people renting in it. So I give them a little bit of credit for trying to stay on top of that.
Davison says landlords are even sprucing up the exterior because they know that curb appeal is huge with parents.
A lot of parents are a lot more involved in where their students live than like back when we were in college, and my parents literally did not, they had nothing to do with my picking where I was going to live. But now you have parents that come through and they want to see something that looks attractive, that looks well maintained. And so, yeah, they want to have security. So that's not cheap, you know, to go reclad part of your building in brick. That's happened a couple times. Not the whole building, but they'll put some accents in, change out some windows, spruce up the landscaping. So that's all to the benefit of the whole community because it's great when things look better.
ISU has a good relationship with the major landlords. That's according to Levester Johnson, Vice President for Student Affairs at ISU. Biggest ones, by the way, are Young America, First Sight, and Sammy. Netzer says Young America has around 50% of market share with 4,600 beds. Still, Johnson says affordability remains a critical issue across higher education. For on-campus housing and dining, for which ISU controls the price, the university wants to offer competitive amenities that impress prospective and current students, like the new Watterson Towers Dining Center expansion.
So all of those things have to be considered and in the mix, but guess what? We have to provide it at an affordable type of rate. So definitely we are concerned about rate issues for on-campus housing, as well as what students are paying off-campus. There are some students who, at some point in their developmental process, you know what? They're done with staying on campus here, and they might want to live within the neighborhood. So we would want to make sure that that's affordable for them as well.
The foundation of the off-campus apartment boom is ISU's decision in the 2000s to decommission those older dorms, partly because it would have been too expensive to retrofit them with fire sprinklers, also to make room for a new student fitness center. Now there are signs ISU may reverse course and move toward more on-campus housing, starting with a study.
We have taken a look over the last year and a half, I believe, at where is our current housing stock, both existing facilities, and what might be missing within that mix.
That comes against a backdrop of strong enrollment and the possibility of more as Illinois' regional universities bleed students and ISU bolsters its own international recruitment. ISU requires freshmen and sophomores to live on campus, but today there's not enough room for everyone. Many sophomores, like Morgan Anderson was, get exemptions to live off campus their second year. Johnson says there are educational benefits of living on campus.
Oh, well, we definitely believe it plays directly into the retention of our students. Any longitudinal study that you will have within higher education definitely demonstrates that the more proximity students have to other campus resources, like number one is other upperclassmen, class students who know all the unwritten rules and policies and things in order to be successful within the collegiate environment, as well as then the number two reason, faculty, having access to great faculty and advisors as to, you know, supporting them academically and otherwise. So the more proximity you have to those resources, the greater your retention rate is going to be on your campus. So residential campuses like Illinois State Universities do extremely well when you have a critical mass of housing and bed space on campus or adjacent.
That new study found ISU lacks enough on-campus housing for sophomores. With the exception of the six-year-old Cardinal Court on Gregory Street, ISU's on-campus housing is mostly traditional shared dorm rooms and shared restrooms inside of towers. There are no apartment-style or pod-style with shared living space options. So does all this mean that ISU is moving toward more housing on campus?
Yeah, I think what we're going to do is we're going to take those recommendations seriously, have conversations again with senior administration within the institution, as well as our trustees, gain some feedback about maybe going to that next level of feasibility and seeing what would be a business plan for such. Where would such type of housing be?
There are several options for where it could be. ISU acquired the site of a now-shuttered Normal Fire Station on Adelaide Street in 2015, possibly to accommodate expansion at Cardinal Court. A ton of Normal officials have also heard rumblings about the now-vacant land east of Main Street near Avanti's, where the South Campus dorms stood until they were demolished in 2012. That would have major implications for local landlords. Here's Andy Netzer from Young America.
It's a concern. We watch that. I say to a lot of people that this is the world's simplest supply and demand economic loop. You just have the supply of students and the available off-campus beds, and it's a one-to-one translation.
There are parallels to 2010, when ISU announced it was building Cardinal Court. Landlord developers criticized ISU then, saying it backtracked on its plans to get out of the housing business. In reality, Cardinal Court only replaced around 900 of the beds that were lost by the dorm demolitions. Landlords just waged a very public fight over property taxes. Young America, First Sight, and other owners objected when Normal Township's assessor revalued 57 different apartments, raising their assessed values and therefore their property tax bills. Last year, they reached a deal with Unit 5, the largest beneficiary of those taxes, to resolve the dispute. But that agreement allows for a reevaluation if ISU enrollment rises or falls by more than 1,100 students. Ed Sauter, the owner of the Summit, says it's still a good business to be in. He lives in Roanoke and is part owner of a John Deere equipment dealership. If something goes wrong at one of his investment properties in Normal, he knows about it right away. More control, he says, than if he'd sent his money to Wall Street.
It's just a slow process of discipline, of making your payments, of renting, of doing maintenance. It's not a home run, but it's just a series of base hits.
Move in at ISU begins the week of August 13th, just 3 weeks away. I'm Ryan Denham.
Take a closer look at the student apartment business with two interactive graphics on our website, WGLT.org.
GLT covers news, lots of it.
State Treasurer Michael Frerix joins us to talk about this.
Non-disclosure agreements are used to protect the accused.
Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors president says 2018 got off to a slow start.
Ryan Denham, Mary Cullen, Charlie Schlenker, along with John Norton and Eric Stock. News coverage paid for in part by listeners during Morning Edition. All things considered, sound ideas, when it breaks, and anytime at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for a wide range of eye conditions, including cataracts, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up on GLT's Sound Ideas, the punk sound of City Mouse. John Norton has more. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. More than 20% of Americans over the age of 65 are still in the workforce. As IPR's Shayla Farzan found, some work to stay active and involved in their communities. Others simply can't afford to retire.
Every day, Mike McLean services machines like this one. A 650-ton behemoth used to make plastic bins. It's hot, dirty work. At 66, McLean is the oldest mechanic at a plastics factory in Union, Missouri.
I get called Grandpa Geezer a lot.
He wasn't always a factory worker. McLean spent 20 years in telecommunications before he was laid off in 2009. After that, finding full-time work wasn't easy.
There's not a lot of companies that are out there beating the bushes looking for somebody in their late 60s to do anything, really. I mean, I couldn't even get a job as a Walmart greeter. Yeah, that felt pretty low.
Fortunately, he was able to draw on the knowledge he'd picked up as a kid, watching his dad fix up old cars. That helped him get a job as a factory mechanic. But those years of part-time work really set him back financially. Now he's not sure when or if he'll be able to retire. And that's been the case for most of his friends and family.
They worked until they couldn't work anymore. Some of them actually died on a job. For somebody to actually retire and travel and stuff like that, that's the Leave It to Beaver family that hardly anybody ever had.
McLean's situation is pretty common. Last year, about 20% of people over the age of 65 were either working or looking for a job. Some work because they have to. During the 2008 recession, retirement savings lost about $2.8 trillion. But Charles Gascon, a regional economist at the St. Louis Federal Reserve, points out that this trend started in the late 1990s, well before the recession hit.
Overall, the decision of more people over 65 to stay in the labor force and work, the recession was not an impetus for that.
Gascon says the reasons why people are working longer are complicated. But a big driver is longer life expectancy.
At the age 65, they're saying, okay, I'm going to live to 85 or 90. That changes how much money you think you're going to need. And then you say to yourself, okay, I've got 30 years now. What am I going to do for the next 30 years? And they decide to continue to work.
Beyond economics, there are also some positive reasons why older people decide to stay in the workforce. Nancy Morrow Howell is a professor of social work at Washington University. She says work also brings meaning and purpose to a person's life.
There's only so much leisure and watching TV and reading. That only goes so far, where there's a yearning for a daily structure, for there's a reason to get out of bed.
Baldwin resident Alan Nissenbaum understands that feeling. The 67-year-old used to co-own a company that brought entertainment machines like Pac-Man and pinball to St. Louis businesses on revenue sharing.
I was in my mid-50s when I retired. And there is quite a bit of time to fill when you retire.
Now Nissenbaum works as a substitute teacher as a way to stay active. He says he tries to encourage his students to continue their education beyond high school. And he likes to give them tips for getting their first jobs, like having a firm handshake.
I try and get invested with real skin in the game as far as being interested in their futures.
Nissenbaum says he plans to keep working as long as he's able. I'm Shayla Farzon.
This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The leader of the Lansing, Michigan-based punk band, appearing in the Twin Cities this weekend, says she left corporate America 15 years ago to follow her true love, music. Misky D. Rodriguez and City Mouse appear at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow. She and bass player Nicholas Richard joined GLT's John Norton via Skype. Rodriguez also fronts the group. She says leaving her mundane job with a building materials sales company in Southern California to do music full-time with City Mouse was a no-brainer.
My only regret, honestly, would be not doing this, like, not starting this path when I was, like, 15. Like, I wish I never would have done any of the other stuff. I wish I never would have gone to school for so long. I wish I never would have, like, gotten, like, had these corporate jobs for so long. I feel like music is what really, really, like, keeps me sane and happy and helps me through every aspect of my life. Maybe things wouldn't have turned out the same. Maybe the songs wouldn't have had the same inspirations or whatever. So I feel like I wish I would have done this for longer.
Do you think it's possible that you know that you've done the right thing because you did the wrong thing?
I definitely think about that all the time. I don't think that any of us would be the same without, like, failures and disappointments and just experiences. You know, we all kind of, a lot of us go through a lot of the same things, like death and loss. We can't avoid those kind of things. They all definitely shape who you are.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to compare this experience, you know, if you wouldn't have gone to corporate America, right?
Yeah, I feel like that exercise song where it says, there's no day worth forgetting, it's the dust that makes up the star, I think is, like, pretty much a good metaphor for that.
And if you're picking up the pieces, just remember that.
This is a really interesting song. Seems like an exercise in affirmation.
Definitely. I feel like that's basically the whole song. It's definitely about, like, I guess finding a respect for who you are without really going through any kind of transformation. Like, just realizing that, you know, your true self rather than, like, you know, being one thing and then becoming another. Just kind of, like, realizing who you are and being happy with that and proud of that.
You're gonna make it because you have to. You're gonna do it because you want to. You're gonna find everything you're looking for, just waiting for you before your eyes close.
Well, it seems like anybody in the arts and music included is trying to work through things. They're trying to express themselves, maybe work things out. punk, I guess the stereotype is they get really got to work things out, right?
I feel like when it comes to punk rock, like it's definitely has been a type of music that has grown out of a necessity for people to be able to access like the music industry. Like, you know, you're not like some rich person who has like a publicist and agents and stuff like that. Like anybody can put out a punk record. That whole scene was very accepting to me, as it's been accepting to many, many, many different kinds of people, like no matter like how different they are from each other or from the mainstream. And I feel like that's just kind of, you know, when you're looking for acceptance, I feel like no one has their arms more open wide than punk rock. That's why I migrated there. And then, you know, and that's kind of why I stay here.
That's Misky D. Rodriguez from City Mouse, who plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington Friday night. Also joining us via Skype, bass player Nicholas Richard. Now, Nick, I'll get to you in just a sec. Hang on. Misky, you just mentioned punk being an accepting scene, and that's why you were so drawn to it. Yet even punk, and especially the music scene in general, is, you know, females constitute such a small sliver of the population compared to males. Why is this still a thing?
I mean, I feel like it's just like, you know, a reflection of just basically the times and the world and everything. I feel like we've always been making the same sound, but people haven't been hearing. And I feel like that's changing and people are finally barely starting to catch up. Even though it seems sometimes like things are radically changing, like I still feel like they're always kind of just been slowly changing. I love seeing that. You know, I don't want to be like, I had to do this and I had to do that. You know, like I'm really happy when like women are given like opportunities that I didn't have. And I'm happy to see it moving forward. And I hope that like it moves faster and faster.
Sometimes I dream that the sun will never rise. We'll all be terrified as the color in our eyes. But then I scream and sit in the real life. It'll be all right because we don't need our sons to sing along to all our favorite songs.
Nicholas, I want to go to you now. By the way, the song is A New Dawn from the latest by City Mouse called Get Right. This is GLT Sound Ideas. Nicholas Richard, the bass player in the band. You are a bass player in a punk band led by a female. Is there a stigma attached to that anymore?
I think it's definitely gotten better, and there's a lot of like bubbles of understanding and acceptance no matter what. We're encountering people who need to be better and behave better and like be more accepting. I've been playing with Misky for a long time, but I've been playing with a female drummer with one of my bands since I was 17. And it's still like a novelty, and people don't, I don't know, like they may think that they mean well in the way that they talk to women in the punk scene. They miss the point a lot. And tokenize it and or are disrespectful. But I think a lot of people are getting better about calling it out or trying to change their behavior. I guess if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make in that you have been playing with females for a long time. Is there a difference playing, and we'll stay with punk music, is there a difference playing with females in a punk band than all males?
I think it's definitely on a person-to-person basis. Like, I really never saw playing with Misky or this drummer, Hattie is her name. I think it would be very inappropriate to look at, to really try to overanalyze that I'm playing with a female necessarily. I more see, like, Misky's like a very strong songwriter, and you know, I tried to compliment her style of guitar playing or let her vocals be the focus point of the songs. There's this particular like City Mouse currently has a female drummer as well. I don't think there's any sort of like feminine energy to the drum playing. I think they're just really good drummers.
Yeah, we'll sing a song together of a new.
Well, let's get to another song on the album. Get Right is the album from City Mouse. And Misky, I'll go back to you. Guardians is the song I want to go into. Let me play just a little bit of it.
There is no heaven, there is no hell. No bells, no one looks down from above. There are no gods.
is this you speaking, or is it another character you're speaking through on this song?
No, I don't think there's any song where it's ever, like, really, like, a character. Like, I feel most of my songs are pretty personal.
Yeah.
That one's definitely really, really personal, and it's just, honestly, it's about my dog dying.
Really?
She was, like, kind of, like, over the years, I've moved a lot, and I've had, like, a lot of ups and downs, and, you know, she was kind of, like, the only really stable thing that was in my life for, like, over 10 years, and she died, in 2012. And that song was written about her.
So where does the rejection of heaven and hell and the whole non-religious idea of the song come from then?
It's just very much like she's just gone. Like, there's just nothing I can do to, like, reconnect, you know? It's just thinking about, like, the pain of just loss, basically, and just what you can do, like, to get through it and or not get through it, you know, what you can do to remember.
Mesquite Rodriguez and Nicholas Richard of the pop punk band City Mouse speaking with GLT's John Norton. City Mouse appears at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow evening. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.